I was sitting in a taxi wondering if I had overdressed for the evening when I looked out the window and saw Mom rooting through a dumpster. It was just after dark. A blustery March wind whipped the steam coming out of the manholes, and people hurried along the sidewalks with their collars turned up. I was stuck in traffic 2 blocks from the party where I was heading. Mom stood 15 feet away. She had tied rags around her shoulders to keep out the spring chill and was picking through the trash while her dog, a black and white terrier mix, played at her feet. Mom's gestures were all familiar, the way she tilted her head and thrust out her lower lip when studying items of potential value that she'd hoisted out of the dumpster, the way her eyes widened with childish glee when she found something she liked. Her long hair was streaked with gray, tangled and matted, and her eyes had sunk deep into their sockets, but still she reminded me of the mom she'd been when I was a kid, swan diving off cliffs and painting in the desert and reading Shakespeare aloud. Her cheekbones were still high and strong, but the skin was parched and ruddy from all those winters and summers exposed to the elements. To the people walking by, she probably looked like any of the thousands of homeless people in New York City. It had been months since I'd laid eyes on Mom, and when she looked up, I was overcome with panic that she'd see me and call out my name, and that someone on the way to the same party would spot us together, and Mom would introduce herself, and my secret would be out. I slid down in the seat and asked the driver to turn around and take me home to Park Avenue.
This is Rosemary Manchester, your host for A Novel Idea. You have just heard the opening paragraphs of The Glass Castle, a memoir by Jeanette Walls, published by Scribner in 2005. The book is highly praised. BookSense, the publication of the Independent Booksellers Association, declared it the number one pick for reading groups. The book club to which I belong, the Aquatic Readers, found it to be a wonderful book for discussion, besides being a good read. The author, Jeanette Walls, grew up in appalling conditions. Although her parents were capable of supporting a family, her mother a teacher and her father an electrician, they turned their backs on society and refused to be a part of it. They didn't provide decent shelter. Jeanette and her sisters and brother were expected to raise themselves, and they did, though they fed themselves out of garbage cans. This is an incredible story well told, and I hope that if you've not already read it, you will do so. The Glass Castle by Jeanette Walls. This story led me to another, closer to home, a memoir of a woman who grew up homeless in Sonoma County. Her name is Clayne Hayward, and her book is The Hypocrisy of Disco, published by Chronicle Books in 2005. You'll hear my interview with Clayne Hayward later in the show. I recently spoke with John Records, the executive director of the Committee on the Shelterless, or COTS, in Petaluma. I wanted to speak with John because they provide shelter for homeless families with children, and it seemed to me a unique resource that's right here in Sonoma County, as well as a perfect tie-in with these two memoirs written by women who were homeless as children. Here in the studio with me is John Records, the executive director of COTS, the Committee on the Shelterless in Petaluma. Welcome, John.
Hi, Rosemary. Nice to see you today.
The first thing I want to do is call attention to your website, which is www.helpcots.org. And I'll be giving that website address several times during the program because I want to encourage people to look at that website first thing. There are wonderful stories there on your website.
There are also some free videos available on that, too.
Oh, excellent.
Short videos.
Excellent. I didn't take time to look at those, but I certainly will. Let me give you a chance to talk about COTS and your work there. I understand you've been with COTS for quite a while.
Yes. I started as a volunteer in 1990, became the organization's first full-time executive director in July of 92. So I'm pushing 16 years there.
Amazing.
Prior to being at COTS, I had been a teacher and also a lawyer. So this is another professional incarnation for me.
And both of those would feed very nicely into the work that you're doing.
Yeah, they do. But I didn't really find myself until coming into COTS. COTS helps homeless people. And we are really committed to doing whatever it takes to help people to heal from the many challenges and woundedness that they have and to get back on their feet and back under a roof of their own. We have comprehensive programs that are integrally developed that take into account the body, mind, spirit of people and not only their subjective sense of themselves but their life in community. We provide safe shelter, housing, food, and really comprehensive skills-building programs like Rent Right, Work Right, and Kids First. We get about 50,000 hours a year of volunteer help, which is the equivalent of maybe 24 full-time unpaid staff. And we have such wonderful volunteer work as a trauma clinic at our family shelter, where PhD-level volunteers who are trained come in and run a clinic for the children, their parents, and also for the staff who are vicariously traumatized. So we just have some amazing, effective programs going on, a lot of support from the community.
If any of our listeners wanted to volunteer, how would they proceed?
The easiest way is to go to the helpcots.org website.
Yes.
And they'll find there a link about volunteering.
Excellent.
And they can find a wish list for our volunteer needs and also for donation needs and get more background information.
Yes. And you work with the Petaluma Kitchen and the Family Connection as well. Could you tell me about that?
Yes. The Petaluma Kitchen is what we'd call a soup kitchen. Mm-hmm. It's really more than that. But it provides hot meals 365 days a year, a ballpark 100 meals, 100 people each day. The Food for Families program, which runs out of the kitchen, delivers about 500,000 pounds of food a year to needy seniors and families in the community, thus helping them not have to make the choice between paying rent and buying food, so it prevents homelessness that way. We also have the Family Connection program, which provides a kind of wraparound loving support that a lot of people can expect and rely on from family and friends, but that homeless people who are getting into a home for the first time or getting back into a home after homelessness need but don't have. So we have wonderful opportunities, and as I think about what COTS is and what it represents, certainly it provides a huge amount of tangible benefit to the homeless people themselves. Tonight, for instance, we are probably having in beds, safe, either in shelter or houses, 260 or 270 people who otherwise would be out on a rainy, cold night. People are getting 100,000 meals a year who wouldn't otherwise have it. Children are getting therapeutic help and licensed child care. People are getting expectations and support as they put their lives back together. They're earning income, they're saving money, they're getting jobs. They're getting help from our clinics to put their lives back together. And perhaps almost of equal importance is what COTS seems to mean to the community as a whole. One of our community leaders was saying, you know, COTS is one of the way this community defines itself. There's a man who touched me deeply when he said that when he has visitors from out of town, he brings them to our Mary Isaac Center because he's so proud that our community has and supports a facility like that. So it's really a privilege to be part of the endeavor and to see how it touches not just the homeless people, but all the members of the community.
And I have here in my hand a book, which you're just publishing,
yes.
A brand new book, about the center, and I think it includes some of your stories about people who've been helped at the center.
Yes.
And it's just off the press, isn't it?
That's right, Rosemary. It's called Invitation to Service, Stories from COTS. It's the fruit of about 5 years of work, almost all of it by volunteers. And it's about, what does it mean to serve? Why would somebody want to bother to help homeless people? And what are the benefits of service to the people who do that? And these are interviews that are done with people who range from homeless people to very wealthy people who support COTS. Mm-hmm. There are probably 20 or so interviews in it, and we've had great feedback on it so far. One woman told me that it was a life-transforming experience to read it, and it really has changed her attitude toward her own work.
Well, that's remarkable.
And the book is available through Copperfields and also on Amazon and really any place that people want to look for books.
Yes, and you'll be doing a reading at Copperfields in June, I understand.
Yes, we're planning to have a book signing and a reading.
And a book signing.
I think on a Sunday afternoon. I think it's going to be January 22nd, but June 22nd. By the way, one of the founders of Copperfields, Dan Jaffe, now deceased, was one of the founders of COTS also.
Is that right?
Yes, and Dan and Copperfields always have been supportive of us.
Oh, that's good to know. And I imagine that other businesses in the community support you as well, I hope.
Oh, yes.
Yes.
A huge amount of support, and it ranges from businesses to kids selling lemonade. There's a group of women who have vowed, the Quilting Angels, that every child who comes to COTS will leave with a handmade quilt that is really a physical embodiment of the love and support that they're offering to the kids.
It's amazing.
Yeah.
In the books that we're discussing today, The Glass Castle and The Hypocrisy of Disco, the homeless children are more or less pawns in the hands of their parents, and these particular sets of parents have taken against homeless shelters, in fact, against any kind of outreach to them. And, of course, it's desperately difficult for the children.
Yes.
Is this a situation that you encounter very often in your work?
For the most part, when we are encountering families, they have their children with them. They have made the decision to take care of their children.
Yes.
And when we renamed our family shelter years ago to our Center for Homeless Children and Their Families, it was intended to really put that emphasis.
Like, yes.
Let's use the needs of the children as a compass for our decision-making and for guiding the parents. We do see, though, situations in which mental illness or addiction warp the sensibilities of people and really diminish their capacity to understand and respond to their children's needs. As we were talking before we went on the air about what would cause parents to neglect their children or to foist upon them really unpleasant circumstances like being homeless, I was reminded of some of the recent research that Kaiser Permanente has done about something called adverse childhood experiences. These are called ACEs for short. And in summary, they are various kinds of neglect and abuse. The Kaiser researchers found that, from their perspective, that adverse childhood experiences are profoundly implicated in adult mental illness and physical ill health. They found also that somebody who had 6 of the possible 8 adverse childhood experiences was 42 times more likely to be an IV drug user than somebody who had had none of those. They also have been found to be profound predictors of homelessness. So I found myself wondering, as we talked about the books, whether those parents had themselves had adverse childhood experiences and the extent to which those experiences had influenced their own choices for their children.
Oh, yes. In the book, it's quite obvious because we meet the older generation, the parents' parents,
yeah.
And their it helps one to understand. But still, the compassion that I have for these children is so powerful,
yes,
that I was very judgmental about the parents. The women themselves who wrote these books continue to love their parents, and to forgive them.
Yes.
And I thought this was miraculous. I know people who say, well, my parents wouldn't let me have a bicycle, and I've never forgiven them.
Right.
Well, here are people whose lives have been made desperate by the actions of their parents, and these women who wrote the memoirs rise above that and forgive the parents and feel free to express their love and even understanding for their parents.
Yes.
It's extremely moving as you read that in the books to find that they're so compassionate. And I wonder, where does the strength of character come from?
Well, it's very interesting. Of course, some people don't forgive. And we often encounter people, both adults and children, who have been brutally abused by their parents. There's a guy who comes to mind now. I guess I won't name his name, but his stepfather would beat him almost every day with a 2x4.
Oh, mercy.
And when he would run away from home, he'd tell the police, please take me any place but home. He was homeless on our streets in our community for about 40 years. And his drinking and drugging, I think, was pretty clearly a response to that. The good news, though, is that people are resilient, that it is really possible to foster the innate resilience that we all have and to support healing that way. And I am impressed by the resilience of the people in the books you're talking about. Mm-hmm. And I've seen in my own experience that people can be helped. Mm-hmm. And if somebody had any concerns about homelessness or the efficacy of programs, if there were one message I'd leave here today, it's that people can be helped. We know how to help them. We don't always have the resources to do that or choose to use the resources. But sometimes people make it on their own somehow. Sometimes they make it with help from a program. Some of the resiliency theory research, which came out of the fact that we've observed people can grow up in really challenging situations, like living in a ghetto. They can come out of a concentration camp. Some people make it and some don't.
Yes.
So why do some make it? Mm-hmm. One of the very important factors is that they encountered somebody when they were young who believed in them, who connected with them, who really kind of gave them a leg up.
Yes.
I remember a woman at COTS who didn't have any of that when she was growing up. Abusive childhood. She was in a military family that moved around a lot, so she was unrooted. She was in jail for some lifestyle kind of crime. You know, she'd done something pretty stupid, maybe a felony drug thing. And the prison matron looked at her with surprise and said, "What are you doing here, honey? You're better than this." And that one thing, that one connection gave her a kind of rooted strength that someone believed in her that really, I think, was the key to her turning her life around.
It's an amazing story.
So you really never know.
You never know.
When you're helping somebody out.
That's right.
Profoundly.
That's right.
And
the women who wrote the memoirs were helped by school teachers and librarians.
Yes. Yeah. I think that would be very common. And mm-hmm. I think you touched on the question earlier about how does this happen? And,
yes.
I think schools are one of the main places, if you can get the kids in the schools,
yes,
where they get this kind of help and stability and rootedness that their own families may not be able to provide them.
Yes. And they get a glimpse of another life.
Yes.
Because when they're very small, they think this is the world. All the
yes.
world is like this.
Yeah, yeah.
And the extent to which their lives can be changed, as you say, by one person reaching out to them.
Yes.
That must be one of the things that keeps you going in your work, to see the change in people.
Yes, it's delightful. The fellow who had been beaten with a 2x4 and who had been homeless, addicted on the streets for 40 years, now has a job in which he's a supervisor. He's got a car. He married. He has a home. And he says there's only one dream that has not been met yet, and that is for him to buy his own home. And he says he's working on that.
Oh, I hope he can achieve that.
Yes, I've seen fabulous healing in people.
Marvelous.
Yeah.
I really appreciate your coming in today, John, and sharing your experiences with us.
Well, I wonder if I'm being responsive enough to any questions you might have about the books.
Oh, yes.
I'm here. I do COTS 24/7, so.
Yes.
you kind of, you ask me a question, out comes COTS.
Yes, but I'm sure that the experiences of the people who wrote the memoirs are similar to stories that you hear. These particular memoirs have happy endings, and I know that not all stories of desperate people do have happy endings. Yeah. But I'm so interested in what makes it possible for people to change their lives, and you've given some wonderful clues as to how that happens. And sometimes it can be just as simple as someone reaching out to them.
Yes. We have something we call the Four Pillars of COTS.
Ah.
C-H-I-I. Connection, hope, intention, and integrity.
Ah.
The idea that we have, and it's not really very profound, but it's borne out by our experience, is that the people who really want, who really intend to have a better life are the ones who get it. That's not surprising. However, for a lot of homeless people, and like the kids you're talking about in the book, their life experience has been such that hope is not a realistic thing for them. It's not reasonable. Why would you hope for something better if you were sexually abused as a kid, if your self-esteem was profoundly impacted by that and you made decisions that were born from that and were using illegal drugs and alcohol, maybe you've got a learning disability also. Why would you hope for something better? So if you can't hope for something better, how could you form the intention to get something better? Well, our job is to fan the flames of hope, to show people that, yeah, in fact, you can have something better. We do that by having people on our staff who have come through the ringer out the other side with beautiful, fulfilling lives, and also by our own experience and confidence in the capacities of the people. We fan the flames of hope in the context of relationship. That's the reaching out we were talking about. That's that connection. We actually intentionally work with developing that bond with people, which is the foundation for fanning the flames of hope that make the intention for something better possible. Then the fourth pillar is integrity. And from that perspective, we really insist that people make decisions that are in accord with their own intention for a better life. So we would say, if you're going to not be homeless, that's what you say that you want because you're in the program, then you need not to be using drugs or alcohol. You need to be optimizing your income to make the most you can of your life. You need to make use of the program or leave and make room for other people. So there's a combination of love and nurturance and connection and also real-world feedback and accountability. And we find those things together can give us some remarkable success. Up to 90% of people in some of our transitional housing programs go on to housing of their own. We have people, as I suggested earlier, who actually go on to buy their own houses. Not everybody does that, but it's beautiful to see. And I realized little by little, this is my life's work.
Yes, it is.
This is what I probably mostly came here to do. And to see people become whole, to see people who are broken come back together, to see them then turn around and help other people is profoundly rewarding.
Must be.
Yeah.
And it seems to me that the world should be knocking on your door and saying, teach us how to do this.
Well, that happened sometime. We had a social work person who's now a professor of social work come from the East Coast to intern in our program. Mm-hmm. We had a young man come from Japan to volunteer at COTS. It's challenging to kind of get it out the door because it's something that has evolved organically, very much rooted in the community and in the values and in the people who do it. Mm-hmm. Still, though, we are learning how to export it. We're giving a presentation in April to a national conference on integrative approaches to trauma and homelessness. And I'll be doing the training for the Mendocino County Continuum of Care about how COTS works. So we have a message of optimism that people can be helped and certainly that they're worthy of being helped.
And the book will help to get the word out. The book is an excellent idea.
Oh, thank you.
And let me give the name of the book again.
Sure.
The book is called Invitation to Service, Stories from COTS. And you can get the book on the internet or at Copperfield's bookstore.
Yes. Thank you, Rosemary.
I think that we owe you a great debt of appreciation for what you're doing in Petaluma. I wanted to ask you, John, I was thinking about the children in these two books, in The Glass Castle and The Hypocrisy of Disco, and how because of their parents' attitude, they were unable, in fact, they were unaware of any social services.
Yes.
Is there any way that either you can reach out to children in that situation or children can find you?
We found that school nurses are a real good connector. The nurses and the teachers generally know what's going on or can suspect with the children, and they bring into play the different resources that are available. We work with children only who are in the context of their families.
Yes.
If a child has run away from home, they might wind up at Social Advocates for Youth. That's another nonprofit organization located in Santa Rosa. Uh-huh. And my recollection is that they have a youth shelter for people to stay in. A challenge is that people running organizations and agencies don't want to enable children to leave home without good reason. So there's a tendency to seek reconciliation with the families. And it's thought that even a pretty unpleasant family is better than life on the street.
Yes.
But on the other hand, children often will leave home because they've been abused in very ugly ways. So I have been extremely impressed by the attitudes of the local law enforcement people. They are really gung-ho about protecting the children and really vigorously and kindly and thoughtfully look into situations where there are concerns about child abuse. A real challenge, though, is that which is a subject probably of another discussion, is the way the whole social service net is being deconstructed because of funding challenges.
Oh, yes. It's terrible, isn't it?
Yeah. Yeah, but I think the local police, they're great. They're great.
I'm so happy to hear that.
Yeah.
That's so good for people to know that,
yes.
That they are sensitive to these issues.
And, of course, the schools are too.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yes, that's very good. We're going to take a break. You're listening to A Novel Idea. This is Rosemary Manchester, your host. My guest is John Records, Executive Director of COTS, the Committee on the Shelterless, in Petaluma. And after the break, we'll hear my interview with Clayne Hayward, the author of The Hypocrisy of Disco. We'll be right back.
You can sing that can't be sung. Nothing you can say, but you can learn how to play the game. It's easy. Nothing you can make that can't be made. No one you can save that can't be saved. Nothing you can do, but you can learn how to be you in time.
In Monterio, near Guerneville, in Northern California. We have lived in a whole bunch of little towns all in this same area, and it is this area, the way it looks and smells and feels, that means California to me. It is the dusty trees along the side of the road that I dream about when I'm in another place and another life. It is the smell of pennyroyal growing near the creek, of warm weeds baking in the sun and giving off their own wild, greeny, honey smell. California means low, rolling hills covered in purple vetch in spring and brown grass in late summer and clumps of oak trees that look wise and patient and lonely. California means driving along narrow roads that wind through little towns like this, with the windows open to catch the smells, and the air goes cold, warm, as you drive through the shady parts and then back into the sun. Monterio sits along one of these narrow, winding roads in the middle of a redwood forest. You're driving through Guerneville and Rio Nido on River Road with the air changing temperature, and then it's bright hot all of a sudden, and you're at Monterio's only real intersection, with a big sign arching over the road saying, "Welcome to Monterio Vacation Wonderland." Monterio is an odd, tilty little town, the hot, bright main street turning back into dim, cool redwood lanes lined with dainty cottages looking like dwarves' houses beneath the towering forest. The light at the intersection looks all hot and bleached, all flooded from the sound bouncing off the tin can lying on its side movie theater. Tonight, we're going there to see a movie. Yellow Submarine, all of us kids, and the moms, too. Maybe my karma was good or something, because guess what? We got to go to the free school. Helene went to go see it and came home with almost new red tennies for me from the free box and a big box of blocks for Hod from the Salvation Army and said, "No more straight school for my Buddha babies. No one will put any trips on you at the free school. The groovy sisters and radical brothers there are in the process of throwing off the bourgeois yoke. But the free school bus doesn't come out this far, so you're going to have to hitchhike to the bridge and walk from there." So we started going to the free school, and this was a great time when every day had a regularness and sameness.
Right, we're back. You're listening to A Novel Idea. This is Rosemary Manchester, your host. That was a reading from Claim Hayward's book, The Hypocrisy of Disco. I had an opportunity to interview Claim not long ago, and now I want to bring you that interview. Claim, it's such a pleasure to talk with you about your book, The Hypocrisy of Disco. And I'm so interested in the title. I know you reference in your story, it's something that you overheard at a drunken party at your grandmother's. But I wondered if you wanted to elaborate just a little bit on how you happened to choose it for your title.
I didn't choose the title. My dear friend, who was one of the first people to encourage me to write, he's a very whimsical guy. He has what I would call an atmospheric consciousness. I was reading him that part where I'm at my grandmother's, yes, New Year's Eve, 1980, and I'm hearing my uncle standing around the stereo drunkenly discussing disco. And he stops me and he says, "There, that's it. That's what you have to call the book." And I said, "But it doesn't mean anything." And he's like, "Exactly. It's perfect."
Well,
so in a way, it was, yes, it's random, meaningless, and it's supposed to convey sort of an adult sense of humor, an adult sense of absurdity.
I know that oftentimes other people name our books. So
yes,
in this case, I think it was fortuitous. Yeah.
Thank you.
I noticed in the credits that you expressed thanks to Peter Coyote. And then he also blurbed your book on the back. And if you don't mind, I'm going to read that to our listeners so they can hear the wonderful things that Peter Coyote says about you. He says, "Claim Hayward has written an insightful and riveting book about a hippie childhood gone bad. She has transformed what might have been an enduring disaster into beauty and wisdom. A testament to her personal resilience and literary skill, this is an amazing story, beautifully told." I'll tell you, it doesn't get any better than that, Claim. Isn't that wonderful?
Peter is he's a great writer himself. I don't know if you're aware of his memoir, if you've read it.
Oh, yes, I know his reputation, yes.
Yes, Sleeping Where I Fall, it even covers some of the same characters as my book.
Ah.
He and my father and my mother knew each other. And in fact, he mentions my mother and my father briefly in his own book, and rather unflatteringly and possibly correctly.
Mm-hmm.
And I have known him since I was maybe two or three. He he was always a sort of distant Zen uncle. Mm-hmm. And then I think my father sent him a copy of this book, of The Hypocrisy of Disco. And Peter was so supportive and so flattering. And I hadn't really talked to anybody about the book. I didn't know if anybody would like it. I didn't know if it was any good. Mm-hmm. I knew that I liked it, but I didn't know if anybody else would. And he is the one who convinced me to send it to Chronicle Books.
Oh, wonderful.
It was this complete gift from the cosmos because I didn't even have to try to get it published. Then Uncle Peter just dropped out of the sky mm-hmm. and helped it to happen. Mm-hmm. And it really felt like a blessing from the cosmos. Like mm-hmm. I didn't even expect it, and I was just, my only response was gratitude, sheer gratitude.
Well, I think you were due for a blessing from the cosmos. You performed such a difficult task with this book to present a story that's really depressing.
It is pretty depressing, isn't it?
But you present it in a way that certainly kept me reading. You know, that's a very fine line that you walk when you tell a story like that, and you need to bring the reader along with you. And I think one of the things that was most helpful to me in following you through the story was your sensory references. On the first page, the smell of rain, and then you mentioned the smell of the river and specific flowers, mildew and mud. I mean, all these wonderful smells. Of course, you were living outdoors at the time, so you were very aware of them. But one of the things that really I really want to highlight is something that you wrote about traveling on the Greyhound bus. Now, I want our listeners to realize that you were on this bus by yourself, traveling from San Francisco to New Mexico. And this is just a short quote, but I want to read it to illustrate how you use the senses here. Greyhound buses smell a certain way, and they all smell the same, which is the smell of fake cherry from the bathroom deodorant they use. This smell pretty much ruined cherries for me, and it stayed the same on every bus, so it was like I was always on the same bus. Also, a dry chemical smell of seat covers, the smell of people smoking on the bus, the smell of exhaust, and flat air conditioning that actually has a smell that is the absence of smell. On the bus, the cold air was always a little too cold, and the hot air was always a little too hot. Now, that is the best description I ever read of what it's like to travel on a Greyhound bus. You not only got that just right, but you brought us onto the bus with you.
Well, I wanted to, it's thank you for noticing that. I actually did choose every word carefully.
Yes.
And that might not appear to be the case because it's written with the sloppy grammar of a 12-year-old.
Yes.
But I did choose words carefully because I love to read and words mean a lot to me.
Yes.
And I really thought about how I was going to convey strong emotion.
Yes.
And a sad story.
Yes.
Without being sentimental.
Yes.
And without whining.
That's right.
And I wanted to involve people.
Mm-hmm.
But I also wanted them to know that I was this person with tremendous hope and some kind of spirit of positivity. And the only way I could think of to do that was to try and express the way I feel about nature. And it was funny because, of course, I complained endlessly, bitched forever about living outside.
Yes.
But I really loved it in a lot of ways.
Yes.
The outside was sort of my interior.
Ah.
So I had to use smells as a sense of interior decoration.
Yes.
Like smells as furniture.
Uh-huh.
And smell as emotion as well.
Mm. I was struck from the beginning in your childhood by your constant exposure to danger. In the opening scene, seven kids, one of whom is you, are bouncing out the door to an ancient school bus parked in the driveway for a slumber party with a candle for light.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, my goodness gracious. And of course, they weren't careful around that candle.
And of course, we were jumping up and down the aisle to the bus and flopping on the bunks and
yes.
throwing blankets and pillows around
yes.
with the candle. Yes.
With a candle. And then hitchhiking to school.
Mm-hmm.
And other dangers I noted were health issues. I don't know if you ever got inoculations. I suspect you didn't.
No, I don't think we did.
And then the danger of malnutrition, and you were often hungry. The lack of supervision by adults or by responsible adults, I should say.
Kind of stunning.
Stunning. And, I mean, you really are a miracle that you made it through all this dismal parenting. When your parents gave you alcohol and marijuana and you were just 12 years old, I wanted to yell, stop, stop, don't do that to her. And then you had responsibility for your little sister, Key, and your brother,
Hod,
to rhyme with Claude. Okay. Mm-hmm. And you felt so responsible for him. And then later in the book, when you're 13 and you're living at your grandmother's, you observe that he went from being a weird kid to being a bad kid. And you say, was it because I always hit him? That just broke my heart that you took responsibility for all the bad things that had happened to your kid brother.
Rosemary, it's still breaking my heart now.
Yes.
I mean, I'm a grown-up, and I've had plenty of time to talk to therapists about this, and plenty of time to be angry at my parents, and plenty of time to get over being angry at my parents.
Yes.
And I've tried to convince myself again and again that it really wasn't my responsibility to raise my brother and my sister, and that it wasn't really my fault that I didn't raise them well.
Yes.
But I can never really believe that emotionally. Yeah.
Well, you can believe that you did your best.
And I actually can't believe that.
Not yet. Okay. Well, keep working on that. You did your best.
Okay. Well, we always sort of choose our problems, don't
yes,
we?
And of course.
Maybe that's something I chose.
Yeah.
Leonard Cohen says this great thing in one of his songs. I don't remember which song. You can't exchange the gifts you are meant to receive.
Wow.
Feeling this sense of compassion for my brother,
yes,
is a gift that I was meant to receive,
yes,
no matter how painful it seems, because
yes,
I often have a hard time feeling compassion for myself.
Oh, yes, that's harder.
So the book was a way of doing that, actually.
Yeah. The another of the really heartbreaking things for me was that so much of this story takes place in Sonoma County,
mm-hmm,
and not that long ago, in the 60s and the 70s. And to think of you living up there in Monterio, which probably looks just about the same today as it did when you lived there.
It's a little more sad and decrepit, unfortunately. I'm so sorry to say that.
Okay. And then for a long time you were camped out in the Redwoods, just living outdoors. And every time I pass that trailer park in Cotati where you lived, and I pass it on the way to the studio, I think of you, your family, living there in a tent. And I go by the skating rink on Stony Point, and you come to mind with your description of how you love to skate. And so you just really worked your way into my mind and my heart with these local place references. So do you come back to Sonoma County at all, to the old places?
I come back to Sonoma frequently.
Clayne, your first school experience was in a so-called free school in which you didn't learn any math. How do you feel now about, I know you're a teacher now, and I wonder how you feel about the free schools.
Well, I loved the free school I went to. Monterio Alternative was just fabulous. I mean, it was this beautiful dolphin painted on the front wall, and all the grown-ups were funny and sweet, and they uh-huh, never bossed us around or gave us any rules. And my mother was a lot more relaxed about letting us go to school. The free school wasn't actually my first school experience.
Oh.
My first school experiences were actually in what she called straight schools, or rather government cage schools. That always kind of ended in tears for me after a month of sneaking cafeteria hot food.
Mm.
I would give up on school because I really didn't know how to interact with my peers.
Yes.
So free school was a lot of hippies, alternative people who practice alternative lifestyles have this one thing in common, which is sort of an inability to assert themselves. So there were no rules.
Ah.
And so the kids just kind of took over, and it was very Lord of the Flies.
Oh, my.
And I remember one part in the book, I really had fun writing this. The grown-ups made this big deal about having gold rush days. And
oh, yes.
You know, we talked about how the white men had come in and killed the Native Americans, and now we were raping the land for gold, and how that just showed that love for gold should never trump love for nature, love for your fellow man. And to illustrate this principle, they had a gold rush, and we were all going to find gold on the school. And the kids, what did the kids do but just rip each other's eyes out and claw each other's hair to get at this gold, which wasn't even real gold. And it just turned into this terrible situation where the kids are pummeling each other and crying and ganging up on each other. It was sort of exactly what the grown-ups were trying to... We were learning exactly what the grown-ups were trying to teach us against.
Oh, dear. A great demonstration.
Yeah.
You often had terrible experiences in schools, and I wondered if the desire to improve that for other people led you into the profession of teaching.
I will be honest with you, that is not the case.
Okay.
I love being a teacher now. It's only my second year.
Oh.
And I love my kids, even when they're monsters. I love them. It was my birthday yesterday, and they all came to the classroom and made fart noises for me because they know that I actually hate that. But I was so touched. So I love these kids, but I didn't decide to be a teacher because I loved kids. In fact, kids kind of irritate me sometimes because they can't really articulate themselves that well.
Yes.
Which I realized that's why my mom was always mean to me, because I didn't really have full consciousness as a child. So I really chose teaching because I thought that it was something that I could do and still write. I thought I could find work anywhere and make a decent living. It was something I could live with and something I might even be good at. Uh-huh. And it was only after I started that I realized that I really like it, and it really works for me. I have a great time with the kids. I'm really empathetic with them.
I can imagine.
And we work hard, and we play hard, and we have a great time. So it's like I came full circle in that way. I'm addressing an issue that I didn't even really know went that deep for me, but which obviously does.
Yeah. My take on it is that you saved yourself by reading. Your reading is what saved you when you were a child.
Yes.
How did you find those books?
Well, Monterio was great this way. Helene, when we lived in Monterio, my mother Helene dropped me off at the library, and she basically forgot to pick me up, which was great. So I just lived there. When we no longer lived in Monterio, I just stole any, and I knew if I knew we were going to be leaving, I would just steal every book I could from the library. And to this day, I think I probably support more libraries in any town where I live than anybody else, because I get lots of overdue fines and pay them immediately.
Yes.
So I'm trying to kind of pay back for all the books I stole when I was a kid.
Yeah.
And then when we lived in New Mexico, it was really very rural. I mean, there wasn't even a stop sign in this town.
Oh, my.
But back when the government actually believed in contributing to the common good by providing things for people that they might not be able to provide for themselves, we had these things called, hello, bookmobiles. So it was so great. The bookmobile would come.
Yes.
I don't remember if it was once a week or once a month, but I would be there hours ahead of time to meet it.
Oh.
It was the greatest thing. Just the little panel truck would come up with all these books, and I could take as many as I wanted.
And then you had the Sears catalog.
Well, the Sears catalog was really, it wasn't just a book. It was a whole other world. It was a world I lived in. I actually think that the Sears catalog sort of saved my life when I needed it most, because when I realized I really was miserable, I mean, nine years old, 10 years old, I'm still okay. I'm still kind of having fun. You know, we're hanging out with other kids.
Yes.
But then 11, 12, the sense of time changes for me. Adolescence is creeping up on me. Things are starting to get weird. I realize that I'm unhappy. And then I found the Sears catalog, and I was able to just disappear into another world.
Yeah.
And I didn't even have to invent the world. It was there invented for me in all of these pink, fluffy bedrooms and girly outfits. And really, if I could just find a Sears catalog from 1978, it would just be like going back to a whole other time and place, to slipping into another universe.
I wonder if it's a case of be careful what you wish for, because so many of the things from the Sears catalog, you found them when you moved in with your grandmother Laura in Las Vegas, and you had all those things, but it wasn't a good experience.
It's very, very odd that it worked out that way, and thank you for bringing that up, because I'll never understand how that happened. My brother and I were sent from our redneck, you know, scrabby-haired father to our kind of uptight school teacher grandmother in Las Vegas, and that was the first time I ever saw a microwave oven, first time I ever saw a dishwasher. We were in a house with wall-to-wall carpeting. We had sheets and towels and pillowcases that matched. I mean, it was unbelievable. We got haircuts. We had toothbrushes.
You had food.
We had our own bathroom. I mean, wow.
Yeah.
3 square meals a day.
Oh.
But the thing is that something really dropped out of my life.
Yes.
Too. It's almost like when I moved indoors, I lost a whole part of myself that I didn't even realize was so important. And I had a hard time writing about that portion that last year. And it took me a long time to figure out why. And because I realized, ultimately, it's because Las Vegas had no smell.
Is that right?
I couldn't summon the emotion
about
Las Vegas because there was no outdoors to it. The sky was the color of tin.
Yes.
It was just busy, you know, six-lane streets and big cars and the Las Vegas Strip and this, you know, beautiful but sterile home. And for the first time in my life, I have 3 square meals a day of anything I want to eat. I mean, within reason, but basically anything.
Yes. Mm-hmm.
And it just didn't taste as good. I'll never understand that.
It's amazing. And everything was artificial. The city itself is sort of artificial.
Right.
Yes.
Right.
That's amazing, the influence of nature on your childhood.
Yes.
Yeah. I want to ask you about another well-written story of a terrible childhood, The Glass Castle by Jeanette Walls. I'm sure you've read it.
I have. I loved it.
Oh,
I could not put it down. I thought it was fantastic.
I do, too. I just love it. Yeah. And there are some similarities, but also some differences in that Jeanette's parents had the ability to make a living had they chosen to do so. And I'm not sure what kind of jobs your parents would have been able to get had they decided.
Well, I actually see my parents as being more alike her parents than different.
Tell me.
Because
mm-hmm.
had my mother and father chose to make a living, I'm sure they could have.
Yes.
They were a little less organized.
Yes.
A little less articulate and possibly a little less manic
than
her parents were. Maybe they smoked a lot more weed. Who knows?
Mm-hmm.
But her parents, it seemed like, were very philosophical and very philosophically inclined and had specific reasons for dropping out the way they did.
I see.
And I think my mother and father chose to believe that they had a specific ideology. And I think they liked to call themselves anarchists or communists or Buddhists.
Yes.
But I also think that they were kind of just kicking back.
It came across that way.
Yeah.
Well, you remember that wonderful scene in the book where Jeanette is in graduate school, I think at Hunter College, and she suggests to the professor that some people are homeless by choice, and everyone just goes nuts at the thought. But it occurred to me that, you know, her parents actually were homeless by choice, as were yours. But children don't have that choice.
Right.
You know, that's the tragedy in it.
Well, that's what's so great about her book, though. I mean, she tells a story that, if anything, is more tragic than my own. And never once do you get the feeling that she feels sorry for herself.
That's right.
Never once do you get the feeling that she's whining. Never once do you get the feeling that she blames them. I mean, she's
right.
Able to express her anger, her sorrow, her sadness,
yes.
her feeling of
yes.
being alienated or isolated.
Mm-hmm.
But never is she condemning them or blaming them. And I appreciated that about her book so much.
And that's why we keep reading
mm-hmm.
her book and your book.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Well, your book ends with the worst birthday party in history when you were 13. I mean, it's just a terrible scene on your 13th birthday. And I really felt bad that the book ended there. Please tell me that you're writing more.
The thing is, I am halfway finished with kind of what happens next.
Excellent.
And I am actually embarrassed about it because I didn't want to write another memoir. I felt like writing a memoir was how I was going to get practice at writing, because I do want to write. I this is my first book. I didn't know if I could be a good writer, so I was going to practice writing a memoir, and so I wanted to move on to something else. But my editor was like, no, no, you have to tell the rest of the story. I mean, what happens next? You run away and join a lesbian ranch in Wyoming. You join the Navy. Fantastic. We got to tell that story. So I am working on that.
You do have to tell that story, yes.
But it's actually really hard, and I'm struggling, and I'm kind of panicked. I'm kind of worried that I only had one book in me.
And it, oh, no, no, no.
I really hope that's not the case.
But it's hard also to tell a hard story about yourself. Well,
really, how do you express these things, especially if you want to stay true to a voice that sounds like what you sounded like at 16 or 18 or 20?
Yes, but don't you find that expressing it helps you move on? I mean, I hate that expression, let's move on. But in some way, it puts it in perspective. I mean, look who you are now. And you've survived that childhood. I don't know. I imagine there are a lot of children who don't make it through a childhood like that.
Speaking of surviving that childhood, I do want to say one thing. The book is, it's kind of hard on my mom and my dad, and you might be led to believe that I'm really upset with them, or that I don't get along with them, or that the book is meant to castigate them. In fact,
no, I didn't feel that
way at
all.
I adore my mom and my dad,
yes.
And I have a great relationship with them, and I don't want anyone to think that this is a blaming book.
Because,
they've both been incredibly supportive, and I'm in fact really grateful to them for how they raised me. So I've had to move on. I've had to get over a lot of stuff.
Yes,
and I did have to survive this difficult childhood.
Yes,
but that difficult childhood really made me who I am.
Yes.
Ultimately, I'm very grateful to my mother and my father both.
But that came through in the book. I mean, I was very impatient with your parents, especially when you were going hungry, but they are who they are.
Mm-hmm.
And you made that clear.
And they're still that way now?
Yes.
And I like them even better.
That's marvelous. That's marvelous. Well, I can't wait for your next book. So by all means, keep writing and let us know how you're coming with the book.
Because, thank you so much, Rosemary.
I want to have it in my hand. So, and thank you so much for this interview, Clayne. I really appreciate your taking the time to talk with us today.
Such a pleasure. I miss Sonoma so much.
When you come back, let us know, because I'd love to meet you in person.
Wave to the trailer park for me.
We all live in a yellow submarine, yellow submarine, yellow submarine. We all live in a yellow submarine, yellow submarine, yellow submarine.
This evening we've been discussing two books on novel idea, both memoirs, The Glass Castle by Jeanette Walls and The Hypocrisy of Disco by Clayne Hayward. And you heard my interview with Clayne Hayward, who was homeless in Sonoma County. My guest was John Records, Executive Director of COTS, the Committee on Shelterless in Petaluma. You can learn more about COTS, including the Petaluma Kitchen and the Family Connection, at the website www.helpcots.org. And the book which they've just published is called Invitation to Service, Stories from COTS. The senior editor of that book is Sarah Cummings. The book is available on the line and in bookstores, and there will be a book signing in June at Copperfields. Thanks to Suzanne Lang, who produces the show. We'll be back on May 14th. You can hear a literary program every Wednesday evening at 7 here on KRCB. And remember, there's no such thing as too many books.